This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. World War II was a so-called good war. It was a battle of good versus evil, at least from the Allies' point of view, so that clear goals were set, and it was near universal buy-in from those on the front lines and those left at home. There are those who believe that experience and our victory in that war may have emboldened us to enter the myriad other conflicts that have arisen since then, most of which were dirty wars, irregular wars, in which the goals were blurry, the conflicts polarizing and particularly bloody, and the results questionable. But in truth, this country has been involved in dirty wars since our founding, the American Revolution being the first irregular conflict. Dr. Russell Crandall believes that we will be involved in an ever-growing number of these irregular engagements in the future. So this Davidson College professor of international politics and American foreign policy wrote a book reviewing our participation in these conflicts through history, with some suggestions on how to conduct them in the future as cleanly and efficiently as possible. His book is called America's Dirty Wars, Irregular Warfare from 1776 to the War on Terror. And he joins us for the hour. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks a bunch. It's a real treat to be here.
Thank you for breaking your sabbatical to do so.
That's not easy. That's not easy, I'll tell you.
Sabbatical, what a concept. we won't go into that right now. Let's start with a definition of
sure.
what we're talking about. Since all wars are dirty.
Of course.
What is a dirty war?
Yeah. And for me, dirty war is irregular warfare.
Irregular warfare.
So what do we mean by irregular warfare? And really, it's everything that regular warfare is not. So we think of wearing uniforms, not targeting civilians, treating prisoners of war humanely. In irregular warfare, that is not the case. We see those types of activities, those atrocities, those violations of the norms of warfare. And the interesting fact for the American experience is how often the type of wars that we fight are indeed irregular. And that's something that...
Almost all of them.
The strong majority. So when you mentioned World War II, something understandably we associate with a regular war, a total war of the mobilization.
Where we have people in uniform.
Exactly.
Fighting other people.
We have army against
uniform.
Army, and we capture territory and capitals. And those types of total wars, those types of regular wars, even have their own elements of irregularity in them. So you think of the United States and Allied forces kind of using terror in the bombing campaign over Nazi Germany to break the will of the German population. So there are elements of this kind of dirtiness, this irregularity.
Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Exactly. And so,
because of the civilian populations involved.
In that case,
right.
Absolutely. At the same time, there are many conflicts that are decidedly irregular. And think of the case of Iraq, Afghanistan, Vietnam. Some of these are big. Some of them are small. And these are the ones that the United States, over this 200-year history, has tended to fight.
Is the United States unusual in persecuting irregular warfare over conventional warfare?
Well, that's an excellent question. In some ways, we don't like irregular warfare. We don't like these dirty wars. You know, we think of our own identity as a beacon of democracy. We think of ourselves as a nation who is reluctant to fight. But once we go into these wars, we win decisively, we win cleanly, quote unquote. The inescapable reality, though, is that even, you know, we might prefer our wars clean, but they end up being dirty, being irregular so often because it can be that our foes want it that way. You know, often we are the preponderant power. We have a formidable military arsenal that we can put into play. Yet just because we want that regular, clean war doesn't mean the foe will give it to us, and they know that.
Isn't this exactly like the British Redcoats versus the colonists? Isn't it exactly like that? They came here They marched in a straight line. They did everything that they did on a European battlefield, and we hid behind rocks and trees.
Yeah, we did hide behind rocks and trees, but what's also interesting in that American Revolution is how much, kind of, especially here in the South, was totally irregular, not just kind of the American patriots behind trees and rocks against a conventional British force, but American on American, patriot versus loyalist, and kind of almost what we consider a civil war, not a war against this imperial power. And you know, within that, you had tremendous savagery, tremendous dirtiness in the American Revolution, something that we don't readily remember and celebrate, even though it was integral to this outcome that led to American independence.
You know, as a kid growing up, when we talked about the American Revolution in school, we learned about Bunker Hill and all those New England battles.
Right, way up there, yeah.
Learned a little bit about the Swamp Fox, because Disney had a show about the Swamp Fox. Never heard a word until I moved here about the Kings Mountain, the Battle of Kings Mountain, October 1780. And you say that that is one of the first examples of irregular warfare during the American Revolution, and it was particularly brutal.
Absolutely. And it's one where the Patriot forces ended up winning in a very unexpected and decisive battle that really turned the tide in the Southern theater. Leading months later to the battle at Yorktown. And in that sense, we think there's so many different kind of moments when you could have a turn of the tide. In this case, it just happened to be a battle at Kings Mountain that came after successive Patriot defeats. And just because the British-led forces decided to kind of hold this line in this one place, the tide was able to shift and kind of have this outcome that many, many people did not expect.
This is in our own backyard.
Right.
And the British did not really throw a lot of British regular troops into this battle. It was colonists who favored – it was the Tories who favored the British, who fought against the rebels, the colonists who didn't favor the British. And it was brother against brother, family against family, and it was nasty.
Yeah, and you think, you know, we don't normally associate terror with the American Revolution, or at least the Patriot role in the American Revolution, and there was terror at Kings Mountain. There were summary executions by both sides in that battle and kind of prior and subsequent ones that just are part of the American experience, but really haven't been part of the American memory.
Is that why it's not part of the American memory? Because we don't want to remember that. We don't want to say this horrible thing happened in Kings Mountain, but it did turn the tide of the war, but it happened down there and it was nasty, it was horrible. We don't do things like that.
That's a great question. I really don't have a good answer for that. I think part of that is if you go to Kings Mountain, and it's a fantastic tour to walk the battlefield. And actually, I do that with my Davidson students as part of a seminar on insurgencies and counterinsurgencies. And if you walk the battlefield, you can see this monument. There's an obelisk, and it marks the 150th anniversary of the battle. So this is 1930, and Herbert Hoover, President Herbert Hoover, was there to lead the commemoration, and there are thousands upon thousands of people in this photograph of this moment. And today it's been forgotten 100 years or close to 100 years later. So the question is why this was sort of a key marker in our history of the war 150 years later, but then suddenly it's just vanished.
Since World War II, the United States has been involved in a lot of different conflicts. Korea, since 9/11, which is what 13 years ago, we have been involved in Afghanistan, the longest war in our history. Prior to that, Iraq. Prior to that, the Iraq-Kuwait War. Prior to that, Vietnam. To those of us who were born after World War II, it seems like we've been at war almost constantly since World War II, and that is not our imagination. And in fact, you say that we have been involved in war almost constantly without interruption since 1776. Really? Well, really? What is wrong with us? Seriously, we think of ourselves as the good guy with the white hat and on the white steed charging in for truth, justice, and the American way. Is war the American way?
Well, it's a really good question. You think of some of these cases, you know, opposing fascism, for one, during the middle part of the last century. Some, I think most people would agree, was a very important time for the United States in its kind of, military conflicts and preventing kind of what was such a horrific ideology to spread across the globe. And then we get kind of to what could be these clear-cut cases into much more challenging ones like Vietnam. You think of, you know, the impetus to go in Vietnam in the 1960s, well, we want to draw the line against communism. At the time, communism seemed like a bad thing, so maybe this is the right thing to do to keep the world safe for democracy. Well, one thing leads to another, and we're in a quagmire, one that, you know, it takes upwards of 50,000 American lives. And so I think that's where the dilemma comes in, is sometimes kind of even these irregular or dirty warfare start out with kind of more noble intentions, rational, convincing intentions, but then end up something entirely different.
Why then, if we've been involved in conflict since the beginning, almost continuously, do we think of ourselves as a nation of peace?
Well, that, again, you have to kind of think of, you know, some people would characterize this American involvement in the world as peacekeeping, right? That a strong America, a America that is able to deter evil, to deter threats.
You're talking about contemporary America. But 1776, we were not a world power. 1780, we were not a world power. 1850, we were not a world power. We weren't a world power, really, until what? After World War One.
Sure. Some would say 1898.
Prior to our being the big guy on the block, were we a world peacekeeper, or were we defending ourselves, or were we being aggressive to expand our territory, or to protect the territory that we already had? What was the story there?
Yeah. You know, one fascinating case, Mike, for me was our involvement in the Philippines at the end of the 19th century and into the early 20th century. And again, many people think of kind of the great kind of American dirty war of the 20th century being Vietnam. And there's certainly a lot in that kind of tragedy to suggest that it was. But the Philippines, in some ways, was equally searing, equally nebulous, in that we kind of started with something that was very localized, a relatively clean or quick and easy success over this sclerotic Spanish Empire in the Philippines and in Manila. But then we found ourselves kind of inadvertently inheriting their colonial war against Filipino nationalists. And then the war turned ugly. It turned dirty. And it became a more maximalist war for us. Very polarizing at home. Yet at the same time, if you look back, some of the kind of key political elements in Philippines today, the rule of law, the public education, kind of came from that nation building. So a very difficult time, very polarizing, but it had its upside.
Dr. Russell Crandall is with us from Davidson College. We're going to continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Live Nation, presenting Chrissy Hynde, November 8th at Ovens Auditorium. Tickets available tomorrow, 10 a.m. at livenation.com. And Dixon Hughes Goodman, LLP, a CPA and advisory firm headquartered in Charlotte. Over 1,700 professionals in 30 offices serving clients in the U.S. and around the world. Details at dhgllp.com. Well, here's a sad statistic. Cancer is the leading cause of death by disease for children in the United States. 42 children are diagnosed with cancer in this country every single day. That's 15,000 a year, by the way. Now, the good news is that the cure rate is increasing, but the treatments are often painful. And the other good news is that there's a lot of research going on in Charlotte in the area of pediatric cancer, which we'll hear about Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the nation reacts to President Obama's plan to defeat ISIS. House Republicans outline a spending plan to avoid a government shutdown. And the NFL comes under fire for its handling of the Ray Rice assault video.
Join us for the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show, this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Russell Crandall from Davidson College, professor of international politics and American foreign policy there, has written a book called America's Dirty Wars, Irregular Warfare from 1776 to the War on Terror. It's surprising in many ways because I never thought that we've been at war almost continuously since the beginning, but we evidently we have. President Eisenhower, when he left office, made a point of warning the country about the military-industrial complex, to keep our eye on that. I don't think we understood what the guy who won World War II was talking about, because we were so naive back in the 1950s. I don't think we really knew what he was talking about. Was he talking about the people who make money from our being constantly involved in warfare, the people who make the munitions and who lobby the Congress and perhaps lobby the president and lobby the political parties and make people into hawks because it's good for the economy, it's good for those companies, and therefore we continuously are on a war footing?
I think that's part of it. You know, I think he saw what was unfolding, and as a military man, it deeply, deeply concerned him. And I think it's...
Why didn't we listen? This is the guy who won World War II. Why didn't we... And he was a Republican.
Right.
Why didn't we listen?
I think in some ways, part of the dilemma then is that military-industrial complex or not during the 1950s, as Eisenhower is presiding and then departing from the Oval Office, we were still at war with the Soviets, and so we had to kind of keep that funding and those programs going. Now you think, okay, when that finally, that ideological war ended in
It was supposed to be a peace dividend.
Precisely, and we got some of that. Yeah. We got some of that.
About
and
20 then, minutes, I think it was.
Historically speaking, 20 minutes. And then we're at the end of history, and no more dirty wars, no more of this irregularity, and then presto, 9/11. And what's amazing, Mike, is if you look at 9/11, and something that I talk about in the book is that all of these dirty wars have kind of their era, their zeitgeist. And so mm-hmm. you think of the Indian Wars being part of Manifest Destiny, kind of the Philippines campaign being part of the era of imperialism, Vietnam housed in the time of the Cold War, and with 9/11, we overnight found ourselves in this new moment of the war on terror, mm-hmm. and so that is what kind of leads us to Iraq and the invasion in 2003. And remember, Iraq was supposed to be a regular war. It was supposed to be a clean war, and amazingly,
because we thought we were going in to fight the Republican Guard of Saddam Hussein,
and to eliminate weapons of mass destruction, okay. To leave behind a stronger democracy, kind of do what Americans do, and initially, and we were going to do this cleanly, and as we all recall, you know, in the initial weeks and months, it looked good, and we had mission accomplished. Mm-hmm. But the world being the world, and war being what it is, you know, in kind of looking at our own history, we shouldn't be surprised that it turned out kind of differently than we had expected. But that's not to say that some of these wars don't turn out as we expect. And that's another part of what I discuss in the book is right. that we tend to remember the failures. The ones that really sear in the psyche are the Vietnams, the debacles, the Iraqs, but there are also the El Salvadors, the Colombias, even after 9/11, kind of American counterinsurgency operations in the Philippines, all cases that probably your listeners are far less familiar with. And I think part of that is because, you know, the body bags didn't come home. They didn't have the polarizing domestic debates, all of things that are associated with failure. And here, you know, so often in the dirty wars of our time, success is amorphous, while failure is very tangible. Yeah. And I think that's why I don't envy President Obama for what he's looking at right now in the Middle East.
So if we have won most of our conflicts, but we forget the wars that we win, because as you say, the body bags don't come home, and the ones that we lose are seared into our consciousness, like Vietnam, why do we continue to go into war? Why not the failures say, whoa, let's do this another way?
Right. Now, it's another excellent question. You think, again, you know, we've had Iraq, you know, we had Afghanistan that started out as the good war, not ending up as good as we certainly had expected or hoped for in the weeks and months after 9/11. And so you would say, let's just stay out of these, right? You know, if they're inherently dirty, if they're inherently messy and polarizing, we don't understand them, we don't like them, we'll just wait for the total wars, right? We'll wait for sort of Nazism, we'll wait for kind of those decisive wars that we can feel good about and that we can win clearly. The problem, though, and sort of the dilemma that faces President Obama looking at this most recent case in the Middle East with ISIL is that the United States does play this preponderant role in the world, for better or for worse, in terms of its military might, in terms of its diplomatic might, and almost by definition, that ensures you're going to kind of rub up against kind of elements that either don't like it, that kind of provoke the United States in a way, and just think of Ukraine, right? Say, well, kind of Putin's Russia is threatening Ukraine, and we don't really care very much, right? And you think, but can an American president go on national television and say, well, kind of, we, you know, Putin is saber rattling in Moscow, but we're just going to kind of give that guy a pass, let him go, because we have to do nation building at home. It's just it's not what the American people identify with. It's not what they want to hear, even though kind of once you have action, then there a lot of people will be asking, you know, where it, as Will Rogers did in the 1920s about our kind of involvement in the banana wars in Central America, you know, where is Nicaragua and, you know, what the hell are we doing there? You know, once, you know, people, you know, are going to start asking, you know, what is ISIL and what in the hell are we doing there? You know, what is Ukraine and what the hell are we doing there? Because now we see the dirtiness. Now we see kind of the costs associated. But at the same time, you know, we could, out in the world, we run up against these and our own identity as a democracy and a beacon.
Did the British run up against this when they were the kings of the world, when they were the British Empire and the sun never set?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You think of just when you have all of these kind of areas in your kind of domain, there are going to be a lot of people that want things otherwise. Exactly. And so, and if you have a lot of arrows in your quiver, it's not surprising that the military option for the United States is often utilized, is often preferred. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, that's sort of what we do well. And that's not to say that, you know, we shouldn't be using a military response against in some of these cases. But it's also when we have already a military-industrial complex, when we have sort of built up this behemoth that is our defense industry, we need to be very, very careful, because the extraordinary blowback, all of those unanticipated costs of this type of kind of maximalist foreign policy, maximalist war fighting, can come back. And if we haven't, you know, if we've, you know, learned anything about dirty wars and the dirty war in Iraq, to think of PTSD, to think of the enormous cost, you know, not even just to speak of the cost to sort of the Iraqi nation, but to our own nation. And we're already living with this. We're a wounded nation, yet now looking at our big foreign policy challenge in front of us, lo and behold, it's more military action. That's remarkable. But it's not out of line with the American experience.
Dr. Russell Crandall not only is a professor of international politics and American foreign policy sitting in an ivory tower.
On sabbatical
at Davidson College. You were also the principal director for Western Hemisphere Affairs, working directly with Defense Secretary Robert Gates. You served under President George W. Bush as director for the Western Hemisphere at the National Security Council. You were part of President Obama's America's team of experts during his first presidential campaign. When the people in the administration and the people working to put Obama into an administration, when they spoke about, and I'm assuming that they did, that's why they had you on board, when they spoke about these conflicts, were they aware of the difference between regular and irregular conflicts? Were they aware that we've been on an almost constant war footing since the beginning of the nation? Were they aware of that? Did that cross their mind? Does it bother them?
Think of President Obama, ongoing right with these dilemmas. And it is kind of ironic and maybe even paradoxical that someone kind of who came in the era, if we had that 9/11 era that led to Iraq and Afghanistan, with Obama, perhaps it was the era of restraint, that we are exhausted. We need to do the nation building at home. Yet he has been confronted with a set of issues where he has actually responded surprisingly hawkishly. And again, I think that's part the broader American context of our identity helps explain that.
Is that because of political pressure? Is it because when you get into the White House, when you get into the Oval Office, suddenly things you can't. You know too much. Yeah. You know more than we will ever know.
I think that's part of it, but I don't think it's all of it. Because
is it military?
Barack Obama was never a peacenik, even though I think some people just assume that he was. And uh-huh. Somebody I'm not against fighting good wars, just don't want to fight the dumb wars. And you can kind of contest whether you think he's fought the right wars or not. I've done it kind of
opened Pandora's box mm-hmm. with Iraq. It was not going to be the easy cakewalk that it was portrayed to be, and it turned out to be anything but an easy cakewalk. And so now we've broken it. We kind of got to fix it. Otherwise, we put ourselves in even more jeopardy, if you believe the Sturm und Drang coming out of all of this. Is that what he finds himself in? He didn't want to go in there in the first place, but we've broken it. We have a responsibility not only to them but to ourselves.
Yeah, I think the difficulty there, and if you saw the president's speech to the nation on Wednesday night, mm-hmm. And what we heard was a president said, kind of, there is evil here, there is a scourge here, and we are going to not only degrade it, but to eliminate it. That's a pretty maximalist goal. But he also said, we're going to do this through airstrikes, and we're going to do this through not our boots on the ground, but other guys' boots on the ground, kind of local, regional boots on the ground.
All right,
and that's more minimalist. And so it's a very, very delicate balance. Because
knowing
I think,
what you know yeah. about war, about our participation in war, about the wars we've won and the yeah. wars we've lost, is there an antecedent to this? I mean, have we done this kind of thing before? And if so, what was the outcome?
Yeah, I hate to punt, given that this is what the book is supposed to be about. But I think if anything, what the book has taught me, what the examination of the American experience taught me, is that we just don't know. But if you do look at some cases, say Libya, in 2011, where initially there was a lot of criticism of President Obama that this was going to be futile, just the idea of sort of trying to do it for humanitarian purposes to stop a potential genocide was out of America's kind of security interests. But with our NATO allies, we went ahead with that campaign, and initially it appeared to be a relatively easy mission. And so everyone is patting themselves on the back. And now look at, jump forward a couple of years and look at Libya, and it's a, basket case. And there's a lot of finger pointing about kind of what we did wrong. Did we take the eye off the ball? And I think what we just it reminds us is that even one that could have been within weeks and months could have looked clean and calm, given just the way that the world is and that what human beings are, it can change in an instant. And so what does that tell us? It tells us that if you're going to do these, just remember that whatever you think it might be, it might not end up that way. And in the interim, the costs, the pain, the blowback can be tremendous.
If, as you say, it is true, let me formulate this in my head first. If, as you say, we have won most of the conflicts that we've been involved in, and we don't really remember that because the body bags didn't come home, what we know is that failure, defeat, is concrete. We see it for what it is, and we understand it, and we want to move on from that. But success is amorphous. Why is it amorphous? And is that why we ask a question about Iraq and Afghanistan as we pull troops out? What have we accomplished? Because we don't know what the goal was in the first place, or because we don't know what the end result was in the first place?
Yeah, well, think of success in World War II, where you have surrender ceremonies.
Right.
You think of General MacArthur in Tokyo, and people are signing papers, and we won, and you lost, and you do it, we say, and they say, yes, sir. That's kind of how we remember kind of success, military success. Yet again, the inherent nature of the irregular warfares, you don't see that nearly to the extent. And so the question of how, let's take ISIL, what would be success? The idea, remember, we thought 5-7 years ago that we'd already defeated these guys. We'd had a success against sort of Western Iraq, kind of ferocious use of special operations forces on the U.S. part, alliances with sort of local good guys. Then suddenly we jump forward till today, and we have this cancer that is metastasizing across that region. And looking at it from sort of this lens of the dirty wars, it's just the fact that it all of the elements are inherently unstable, and we don't have governments and states and borders. We don't have kind of unanimity in ideology or religion. And so when you put that all together in that cauldron, it's just going to make it sort of impossible to evaluate. Really,
well, shouldn't that tell us to stay out?
Well,
we don't understand it. We don't understand.
Yeah.
Even if we lived there and grew up there, we still wouldn't understand it. It's so complex.
But again, we think of there also genocide, right? You can stay out. We don't have a dog in this fight. Often, sort of the metaphor used, but there can be outcomes that our own kind of identity. We have said we very much regret. That we regret kind of not going doing kind of more in Rwanda. A decade ago, that we should have intervened much earlier in the Balkans. And so it cuts both ways.
Well, maybe we'll pick up on that when we come back, because I think we do pick and choose, and we sometimes wonder why we chose certain things over others. Dr. Russell Crandall's book is called America's Dirty Wars. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Medtronic. Almost 3 million Americans suffer atrial fibrillation, or AF, and irregular heartbeat, which may increase the risk of hospitalization. Details from a doctor or at medtronic.com/aboutAF. And Blumenthal Performing Arts presenting Under the Street Lamp with Gentleman's Rule. Former Jersey Boys sing Motown, The Beatles, and Four Seasons, September 23rd in Belk Theater. Tickets at 704-372-1000. It's Friday. That means it's the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show at 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. The National Hour first. The nation reacting to President Obama's plan to defeat ISIS. House Republicans outlining a spending plan to avoid a government shutdown. And the NFL comes under fire for its handling of the Ray Rice assault video. Just some of the topics they'll be talking about in the first hour, the International Hour at 11.
Work as we know it is changing, both the kinds of jobs and where they get done.
I don't think it's that strange. I mean, it's 2014. We're already dating online. We're sharing our homes for strangers to live in, and we pay a lot of money to live at our homes. Why can't we work at home?
As in somebody else's home, that is. I'm Kai Rizdahl, a new startup for the remote workforce, next time on Marketplace from APM.
That's Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Russell Crandall is with us, professor of international politics and American foreign policy at Davidson College. He served with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Office of the Secretary of Defense of the National Security Council, and he's the author of several books, the latest of which is called America's Dirty Wars, Irregular Warfare from 1776 to the War on Terror. And in case you're just joining us, it may surprise you to learn that we have been at war almost constantly. Since 1776. Most of those wars were not regular wars. They were irregular wars or dirty wars. And we've won most of them. But we've forgotten all the victories. We remember the defeats, which is odd to me. And it isn't just that America was involved in these irregular conflicts. You cite one database that demonstrates that of the 464 wars from 1816 to the end of the 20th century, only 17% were conventional conflicts, which have armies against armies, nation states against nation states, civilian populations not being targeted. 79 of those conflicts between countries and armed forces. 385 conflicts, or 83%, were either civil wars or insurgencies. Now, we've been familiar with insurgencies in Iraq and Afghanistan. Define insurgency.
Well, an insurgency is when you have one element, one belligerent who is attempting to overthrow what could, as political scientists call, a polity or the government or state. And so you would think of insurgents during the Cold War in El Salvador, Marxist insurgents who are attempting to overthrow the government in the capital. And so it gets sometimes a little sticky between what is an insurgency, right, that a group on the outside that's trying to overthrow the folks on the inside, mm-hmm. versus a civil war, which we tend to define as these two polities, two peoples, two armies within kind of one country fighting each other.
So in Iraq right now, yeah. What do we have?
All of the above. I bet you if you asked ISIL, they would say maybe it's not even a civil war because they have their own state. But popped in my head is that it gets very political fast, right? It's so often when you have insurgents, you ask kind of the government. The polity, you know, who are those guys? They're bandits. They're just thieves. They're terrorists. But if you ask the insurgents, we're freedom fighters. We are noble. And often it's the insurgents who will contend this is a civil war because we have a half, a share, a majority of the population on our side. So it can become very
– And you want to make clear the fact that insurgents are not necessarily terrorists.
Right.
What, until they resort to terrorist tactics?
Sure. Insurgents can use terror, and counterinsurgents can use terror. And when counterinsurgents use terror, we often call that scorched earth policy, right? The idea that the insurgents tend to be the weaker force, not always, but tend to be the weaker force. And so the counterinsurgent says, okay, well, we can't kind of find these people because they're in the hills, because they're in kind of clandestine cells, and so we have to eliminate the civilian population that aids and abets them. And so that's where you're going to run into trouble with terror on the counterinsurgent side. What's interesting about the American experience, Mike, is that almost always the United States has been on the counterinsurgent side. We started off, ironically enough, in the American Revolution, as we discussed, mm-hmm. on the insurgent side, and that has become sort of a storied mark in our history and our identity. Over the past 200 years, with a few exceptions, we've been on the counterinsurgent side. Part of that because we are the big guy on the block, and we tend to be the ones protecting the status quo, protecting something against kind of these kind of weaker insurgent forces. And that's, I think, what where it gets very interesting in the case of ISIL. And again, I'm not a Middle East expert, and certainly not an expert on kind of what's unfolding right now. But you know, what is this we're going after? You know, if it's an insurgency, is it a state? Is it, you know, this is just terra incognita in terms of how we understand the threat.
Let me ask you about ISIL.
Sure.
Because you and the president insist on calling them ISIL, and everybody in the media is calling it ISIS.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, you know, again, I'm not an expert on this, but I think part of that is just kind of the ISIS of what the, if I understand it correctly, of sort of what they consider themselves. And I think it's the difference between sort of the Islamic State of, for ISIL, of Iraq and the Levant versus the Islamic State of Syria. And so but it could be some of that.
Isn't Syria part of the Levant?
I'm sorry?
Isn't Syria part of the Levant?
I think it's the notion they have of Syria is different than sort of what the nation state is. So it you know, is there something political behind the one or the other? If there is, I'm not aware of it, of why the president would prefer to use that.
Okay. Because it sounds like a political position point that he's
That's
making.
Often the case.
Internationally.
Very, sure, and that's a good thing. We should be very clear sort of if just because they want it, you know, and we think these guys are evil, that we shouldn't play their game.
Now, we do pick and choose the conflicts
that
we get involved in. You know, we got involved in Iraq and Afghanistan as a result of 9/11. We did not, however, get involved in the conflict in Syria. We did not get involved until recently. Did not get involved in Somalia. We have chosen not to be involved in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, except for putting sanctions on Russia. Is there any pattern to how we, or reasoning behind how we pick and choose what we decide to involve ourselves?
Yeah, and I think that gets back to the zeitgeist, right? That if right now we are in the era of restraint. And so I think there's a lot more hesitation because we already had Iraq and Afghanistan. And so if for example, you know, Iraq had been the cakewalk that it initially appeared to be, if we had sort of a mission accomplished, we went home, suddenly it's a shining city on a hill of democracy, maybe then we would have kind of assumed that, well, these are kind of easy nation building, kind of going and changing societies, you know, inside every kind of Iraqi or Syrian is a, you know, apple pie eating American kind of flag waving kind of democracy loving person waiting to get out, and we would have been sort of more maximalist in a place like Syria, but that didn't happen. And so we got bogged down in Iraq, and the kind of feeling was we can't endure another one of those. And I think that sobriety is what deeply influenced President Obama's thinking on Syria. Now everyone is saying, gosh, if we had just armed the rebels earlier, if we arm them now, kind of we can win this thing.
But if every period of war has its own zeitgeist, if we fought the Native Americans because of westward expansion and imminent domain or whatever you wanted to call it, manifest destiny.
Yeah.
And we fought World War I to end all wars, and we fought World War II to defeat Nazism, and we had the Cold War to defeat communism, and now we have the War on Terror. Each of those conflicts and periods had different justifications for going to war. So can we learn anything if every time we go to war, we're in a different period of justification?
Yeah, well, they have justifications, but you also have to keep in mind that we had justifications for not going to war, right? That sometimes, you know, the lesson learned is that it's a slippery slope, that it's a quagmire. Think of Vietnam. That kind of debacle is what kind of led many people to think, you know, why would we hesitate to get involved in the Balkans? Why would we hesitate, or why would we flee so quickly when 18 American servicemen were dragged through the streets of Mogadishu in 1993? Because, you know, we know when we start these things, they just end up as Vietnams. And that didn't have to be the case. And sometimes sort of belatedly, we came around to this idea that, okay, the Americans, you know, either – you know, when you use force, it's not going to necessarily have the same outcome as something, another conflict that looks very, very similar. And it's funny when you see different episodes of ongoing American conflicts, mm-hmm. and how people we respond to them. Everyone has their default, right? Oh, Afghanistan, it's Vietnam all over again. I see it, right? We've lived whether the lies or the. Everyone kind of has that, or okay, it's Syria right now. Well, we know kind of what happened with Iraq, so it's going to be Groundhog Day, and it can be Groundhog Day, but it also we have to be very careful that it might not, and so that can we just everything is unique, and that's why what you don't need is bluster. What you don't need is sort of John Wayne. Diplomacy, John Wayne foreign policy, where...
Well, now you work for the George W. Bush administration. Wasn't that what they were employing?
That's a different discussion about kind of what we think of the George W. Bush administration. But I think kind of looking at to me, what's so worrying about the contemporary era is how politicized the rhetoric is. You know, everything from the kind of the consumption about kind of winning political points of kind of appearing tough, kind of who is the winner and the loser politically in the characterization of this fight. And jump back to 9/11, right? We're hit and sort of we have members of Congress sort of bipartisan on the steps of the Capitol sort of singing patriotic anthems. And, you know, today it seems if we've gone wayward, and I think that's it. Given the consequences of these wars, given sort of what we're asking our service men and women to do, you know, to go in harm's way, and needless to say, kind of the impact, the suffering that we inflict, either kind of often unintentionally on kind of civilian populations, on foreign nations, it should make this the most sober of discussions. And I think that right now, unfortunately, the discourse you see among our political leadership doesn't reflect that.
Given your experience in Washington, let me ask you about this, because not only have we lived on a constant war footing, since 9/11, we have lived on a constant fear footing. We are constantly being told that the security alert is up to red, that we're going to be attacked, that we are in danger. The United States is in danger. The homeland, a word which I abhor. I'm just going to say that now because it sounds like fascism to me. But the homeland is in danger. Are we, in fact, in danger? Obviously, a terrorist could strike at any moment. There's no question about that. But are we, in fact, as a nation, as a people, as a continent, in danger?
Well, again, how we would define danger and kind of what threshold we're willing to tolerate is a very difficult question. But I think you are asking a very important question, and you know, think about kind of what, as a society, as a democracy, and an open, vibrant society, are we willing to tolerate in the name of these threats? What will it cost, and what will it do in terms of? Let me just give you one example. I was with my family earlier this summer, and we drove up from New England to Quebec City for a couple days of vacation. On the way back, returning across the border, and this is into Maine, mm-hmm. and you think, okay, well, you're going to have a cursory border check. Well, you've got this kind of massive construction, very sort of post 9/11 war on terror kind of era of rigorous scrutiny of our destination, of our car credentials and insurance and everything else. So it was whatever good this is doing, and I'm sure it's doing some good of keeping bad guys out. But what costs does this have to our society? Just the kind of the freedoms and kind of the movement that so much that we would, I think, many of us would agree is what makes us so unique and such a kind of inviting place to live.
I guess my question, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, we're running out of time, but my question is not so much the border controls and getting on an airplane and things like. My question is, it's fear, constant fear is being used to justify further incursions. Is that Is it trumped up?
Yeah, I don't think so.
You don't think it's being trumped up?
No, I don't think it's intentional. Let's just scare the – I think it's more – yeah.
The point of this book was also not to insist that we not fight these wars, but to consider how we can do so as cleanly and successfully as possible. So what conclusions did you reach in the 2 minutes that we have left?
Well, I think for I think if I've heard any criticism of the book so far, it's that I don't have enough prescriptions. You know, what should we do? And I think as I kind of wrote the book, I realized that really I didn't want a prescriptive book because first know your history, first kind of know the El Salvadors, the Colombias, the Iraqs, the Philippines, in it, the Kings Mountains, because it's when you know that, when we can kind of understand sort of the good, the bad, and yes, the ugly of these irregular wars in our experience, I think we are going to have a lens through which to look at these issues, the ISILs.
But all of those wars involved boots on the ground. All of those wars involved people losing their lives on the American side. As we move toward drone warfare, what impact will that have? Will that embolden us to do more? Will it cause others to use them against us?
It could. And I think President Obama has talked publicly to the nation about this, that we need to be very careful with this technology, because could it allow us just to simply snap our fingers and conduct war without actually kind of being in war,
right?
You know, by remote control, literally. That is where technology has kind of almost gotten beyond sort of our idea of fighting these types of conflicts.
Dr. Russell Crandall, his book is called America's Dirty Wars, Irregular Warfare from 1776 to the War on Terror. Thank you for the hour.